This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. No matter where you stand on the issue, you're expected to stand somewhere. But how often do you talk with someone who holds a different view? Six women from Boston decided it was time to talk. Half described themselves as pro-life, half pro-choice. 6 years ago, they started meeting secretly. That was 8 years ago, after two women were shot to death at a women's clinic by a man named John Salvi. 1 year ago, they went public in an article they wrote for the Boston Globe. NPR's Margot Adler spoke with four of the women over the weekend. Today, two of them join us to talk with you. Do you know where your friends stand on abortion? Are you able to talk with them if your opinion differs from theirs? Is talking with the enemy a constructive step towards dialogue or a betrayal of the cause? Our telephone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, the latest on the situation in Kuwait as American forces pour into the country. An American contractor was killed earlier today in what's being called a terrorist incident. But first, talking about abortion. With us now from the studios of member station WGBH in Boston are Nikki Nichols Gamble. She's director of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, served as president and CEO of the Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts for 25 years. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Madeline McComish. She serves on the executive board of the Massachusetts Citizens for Life, is their past president. Welcome to you, too.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Can each of you describe your feelings as you started this dialogue? Were you anxious? Nikki Nichols Gamble, why don't you start?
When we began the dialogue, I think all six of us were enormously anxious. We knew that there were things that might be able to be accomplished, but certainly, speaking for myself, I wasn't particularly hopeful.
Hopeful of what?
Well, the major rationale that brought me to the dialogue was hoping that through a conversation we might reduce the lack of civility in the dialogue and rhetoric, and that we might diminish the violence and hatred that was occurring between the two sides. Mm-hmm. And I must admit that although I thought it was worth a try, I wasn't terribly hopeful that we could do that.
Madeline, did you feel the same way?
Oh, yes. I was very nervous going into the conversations. First of all, because I had never really dealt with the opposite side on a personal level, but always sort of in a debate situation. And I'm afraid that I held stereotypes of the people on the other side, as they admitted to us they held stereotypes of us. And as Nikki says, I wasn't sure we could accomplish anything, but I thought we had to try.
The point I should emphasize was not to convert one side or the other.
That's correct. It was to try to reduce the level of tension in the city. It was a very, very tense time.
Nikki, was it easy to even start talking? I've read in your article that one of the things you really had to do was establish ground rules.
I think that despite our apprehensions, our facilitators, Laura Chasen and Susan Podziba, made it actually quite easy to start the dialogue. Their job and their expertise was such that they knew how to bring people into a room with drastically opposing opinions and set up some ground rules that made it possible for us to open a dialogue and, in fact, continue it. So I think as we started, we were probably all fairly surprised at how easy it was to do it when you stick to some rules of civility and rules of making it possible for everyone to talk. Now, that's not to say that there weren't moments of pain and moments of real difficulty as we really came right up close and confronted the vast differences between us. But I think the process made it possible and even easy as we went along.
Yes, I was amazed as I came out of that first meeting at what had been accomplished. As Laura Chasen explained on the All Things Considered show, the first four sessions were extremely tightly structured. And Laura explained on that show that when there is a high level of anxiety, it is very necessary to have a very tight structure. And those first few meetings were very tightly structured, but they went beautifully thanks to the facilitators, as Nikki said.
One of the things that we did in one of the early meetings was to list what each of us or each side thought of as hot buttons, as the terms that made all of us just cringe and tended to stop dialogue. And we agreed to try to avoid all of those hot buttons in our conversations. So part of it was learning a new language, a new way to talk about the divisiveness on this issue. And it was very powerful.
It was not easy, though, because it was very hard sometimes to express yourself without using certain words. And they put lists. There were big sheets on the wall with all the lists of the hot-button words that we were asked to avoid.
Would it be a violation of your rules to ask what those hot-button words were, if you could mention them now?
Oh, certainly. Termination of pregnancy on our side, and products of conception, for instance, and I'll let Nikki name some on her side.
Okay.
Well, one of the ones that was most difficult for me was to use the word pro-life to describe Madeline and the two other colleagues that represented her side. Everyone else was able to use pro-choice and pro-life throughout the whole dialogue. I was not able to do that because I consider myself pro-life, and I just wasn't able to try to distinguish Madeline from me using that word. So I had a difficult time all the way along, actually, with that one.
How much of an intellectual challenge was this, Madeline?
It was extremely challenging. And I think that's one of the things that kept us coming back. Because when you really have to dig very deep to explain why you believe what you believe, and also listen extremely carefully to the other side to really try to understand what they are saying and not what you think they are saying, it's a very strenuous intellectual exercise. But as I say, I think that kept us coming back. Don't you think, Nikki?
I do. I think not only the intellectual challenge, but the emotional challenge of it was very sort of was always present as well. I think most of us on issues in which there are major divisions tend to talk primarily with those with whom we agree, and in fact purposefully avoid conversation with those whom we know there are great differences of opinion. And I think one of the enormous values of this kind of dialogue is it indeed provides a learning experience. You can not only learn to understand at a much deeper level the opposing point of view, but you learn to articulate your own view, I think, much more clearly and effectively.
Yes, you have to. And Nikki, I remember you said it's not interesting talking with people who agree with you.
Right. Well, it really isn't. You know, you don't learn anything that way. That's a little extreme to say, but you learn a lot more if you're talking with people in which there are profound differences.
Our telephone number to invite all of you, whatever your differences may be, to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address again is totn@npr.org. And let's begin by joining Dawn, who's with us from Boise, Idaho.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
This discussion is so apropos. Last Thursday or Friday, I think it was, I was returning some videos, and I drove by a demonstration downtown. I didn't even exactly know what it was, but it was striking in that it was a whole field that was set up like there was a probably 300 or so well-organized white crosses, kind of like a World Veterans Memorial. And this is the first time I felt that, you know, I had no idea what was going on, but I kind of yelled out my window. I said, hey, what are you guys doing? And they said, oh, this is a demonstration for, you know, we're having a vigil for all the lost babies. And I thought, I went and returned my videos, and I came back, and I walked up, and I didn't go up, you know, in a certain, you know, I wanted to understand where they were coming from. And so I'm so glad you guys are talking about this. I really feel like there's two sides, and it's either black or white. And there was a gentleman there that, you know, had a sign, and we were talking, and I listened to what he had to say, and he listened to what I had to say, and I thought, you know, that's the best way to approach this subject.
Did it change your mind at all?
It did. You know, he came from a similar background, which I had no idea. I was raised Mormon, and I come from a huge family. And he said, oh, well, yeah, I have 15 kids. I'm from a Mormon background. And, you know, we had an instant, you know, understanding there. And he, you know, told me about his stance on this. And I said, yeah, I'm actually pro-life myself. If I were pregnant now, I would choose to have the baby. And, you know, fortunately enough, I'm married. I'm in a circumstance where if I was, but who am I to judge anyone else's circumstance? And I've done a lot of traveling, met a lot of people in my life. And, you know, he agreed. He didn't attack me.
Nikki Gamble, are we seeing a little bit, has the rhetoric ratcheted down over the last several years, do you think?
Well, I think that the rhetoric in Boston changed fairly substantially over the period that our group was meeting. Part of that was because all of us at the time were key leaders in the movement, so that we were the people to whom people went for quotes and for comments and for programming. And I think our commitment to speak civilly with one another really was manifested in the way the media covered the issue.
Don, did you find it was you were able to have a regular conversation and proceed on your way feeling like you'd learned something?
Well, I felt like that, but I think that just in our dialogue, you know, a few people around us kind of sensed where I was coming from, and they did become kind of angry, and then because they were angry, I became angry, and then I said, you know, wait, I backed up after I, you know, had a few words that I regretted, and then I said, I apologize, I don't mean to get into this. If you guys give me 5 minutes, you know, these are people that hadn't heard our discussion, and I said, give me 5 minutes, I'm a nice person, you know, and I felt like we need more a forum, whereas I was on their turf, and I can understand why they became hostile after a while, and I became hostile as a result, but I think we need forums like these ladies are talking about, where we can have intellectual and smart conversations, where, you know, I can talk about the experiences that I've had of women who have had to have this choice. And, you know, I told them, frankly, I'm glad I can be standing here talking about, you know, these people who were able in this country to have this choice. And one gentleman agreed, and I was surprised, you know, a gentleman with 15 kids, but, you know, I feel like it was more the forum than anything.
Well, Don, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about how to talk about abortion with somebody who completely disagrees with you. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Has this issue affected your friendships or maybe even your family relationships? Give us a phone call. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how Americans often struggle to talk with each other about abortion. Our guests are two members of the Public Conversations Project on Abortion, Nikki Nichols-Gamble, director of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, who served as president and CEO of Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts for 25 years, and Madeline McComish, who serves on the executive board of the Massachusetts Citizens for Life, is their past president and a member of the Public Conversations Project. They're at the studios at WGBH in Boston. And can I ask you, you elected to decide it, I think the ground rules of these meetings initially were that they would be held in private, very strict confidence. Why was that? Madeline, why don't you start?
Well, it was very necessary, I believe, at the time that this be held away from the glare of the media spotlight and that we were able to speak totally confidentially to each other as individuals, not representing our organizations, but as individuals. I don't believe the talks, they could not have taken place otherwise.
Why did you eventually decide, Nikki, to break the confidentiality?
Over time, I think we began to feel that we had some important things to say to the general public and even to our own constituencies about this issue and about the value of discussing it among ourselves, so that we came to that decision. We had all moved forward in our professional lives and in our personal lives, I think, to a point where we felt less vulnerable personally and more sure that we had a message that could be useful in the public. And then we spent a good amount of time trying to design the way to go public, talking about a whole variety of alternatives. And we settled on one in which we had significant control, and that was to write the article for the Boston Globe in which all six of us agreed on every single word in the article. And it took us approximately a year to write it, I think.
I can imagine. Yes. Hard enough to work with one editor, six people in consensus. That's quite a challenge.
And everyone had to agree to every word, so
there was a point at which I thought it would never happen.
There was a time, yes, when I thought it wasn't going to fly ever, that this is it. But we kept going, and it finally we did publish it. And the Globe was very good in giving us the control that they did.
What did you talk about in these meetings? I mean, you were both firm in your views and knew that the other side was not going to be coming over to your intellectual viewpoint. So what did you talk about?
Well, we talked about a lot of things. I mean, one of the main things we did is we talked about abortion and almost every substantive component of the topic. You know, we talked about teenagers. We talked about sexuality education. We talked about partial birth, DNX abortion. We talked about the events in Boston and how they had impacted the two sides. We talked about one of the most interesting conversations we had over time was the worldview of the two sides, which really was what helped us, I think, begin to define the differences between us. Madeline, what else do we talk about?
Yes, well, that is pretty well. We talked about, as you say, lots and lots of things, and most things we did not agree on. But as Nikki said, we talked so that we came to the realization that there was a really substantive difference in our worldviews. And when you said that you came to realize, you knew you were not going to convert the other side or convince the other side, well, that was one of the things that we agreed to, was not to try to convince the other side of our position. But I have to say that I had always hoped that I could do that. But one of the most painful times in the conversations came when I realized that that never was going to happen, that our worldviews were so drastically different that we essentially, there was a very deep chasm there. And our affection for each other reached across that chasm, but that chasm is there and will always be there.
I mean, one of the major differences between us, I think, is that the side that Madeline represents really did believe, I think, that they would convince us over time that we were wrong on this issue.
Don't all of us feel somehow that, you know, if I could just really explain how I feel, then they'd understand.
Right. Well, I don't think our side ever felt that way. I don't think I ever believed that there was anything I could say that would change the mind of Madeline, Fran, and Barbara. So I really didn't have that hope or that expectation. I was simply interested in trying to be clear about where I was on the issue and why, not to change the hearts and minds of the others. The one part that I would like to have changed was their interest and commitment to making it impossible for me to act on my point of view.
I'm sorry, what did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I for example, I have a lot of respect for the point of view that Madeline has on this. The only part of her viewpoint that I don't respect is her commitment to making abortion illegal. She, I think, on the other hand, would say she just really doesn't respect anything about my position.
Well, I respect the fact that it's sincerely held by you, but the position itself I really cannot respect because I believe it's an error. I mean, as I say, I respect Nikki and Ann and Melissa very much, and they sincerely believe what they are talking about when they talk about abortion. And I do respect their belief, the fact that it's sincerely held and that they have goodwill. But the position itself, I cannot respect.
Well, joining us now from her office at Georgetown University here in Washington is Deborah Tannen. She spent much of her career examining how we talk with each other. Her books include The Argument Culture, Moving from Debate to Dialogue. And Deborah Tannen, always good to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Why is it so hard for us to have one-on-one conversations with each other about abortion?
This is an issue, as many that we deal with today, that has been polarized and put into the most extreme terms by the public discourse. And I want to congratulate you on this program today. It is so reassuring and so enheartening to hear an attempt of the two sides, and just by saying two sides, I feel uncomfortable right there because it's a very Western tendency, and Americans do it especially, to reduce everything to two sides. People's feelings and opinions on the abortion debate are very complex, and when people hear it reduced in a way that it polarized in a way that they don't see themselves fitting in either side, then they feel like it doesn't have anything to do with me, and they turn it off. I think it's especially complex because of the tendency to demonize, to name call, and as we're hearing, these hot button terms. It's the same kind of thing that I talk about in a book called "I Only Say This Because I Love You," about family conflict. And I was very moved by the ground rules, and I read about this in the Boston Globe article that they had agreed on, that they would not interrupt, they would not grandstand, and they would not make personal attacks. And I think this is a good starting point, and it's very often not the starting point in conversations with people who are seen as opposing each other. I would like to make one point, though, and another danger of the two sides issue is that it can sometimes reduce real differences and create an equivalence that may not be there. So, for example, I was very moved by the statement, again, by the women in this group, that because they got to know each other personally, they cared about each other, and we can't overemphasize the importance of that, of a personal connection, so that you're not seeing each other as really less than human, which is what happens when there's no personal connection and there's that demonization. And one thing they mentioned is that because of that trust, a hotline was opened so that the pro-life leaders, and I'm using the terms that each prefers for themselves, and I thought that was an important point too, the pro-life leaders were able to alert Ms. Gamble when there was a possibility of imminent physical danger. And she said how deeply moved she was that there were people on the other side who were concerned about her safety. And in reading this, I kept thinking, well, the physical danger aspect only went one way. And that is something that makes perhaps less of a moral equivalence between what we're here picturing as two sides.
I wanted to get back to you when you're talking about the two sides and what it does to people who don't necessarily identify with either side, who find themselves in the middle. Are they squeezed out?
Yeah, and we all have seen this happen in shows, and again, your guests have mentioned this in their own experience. I've had it myself, that when you're invited to be on a public talk show, obviously not NPR, although NPR is totally immune from it, but much more on television and other radio stations, if you don't take an extreme view, you're quickly dismissed and they don't want you. Or when you're up there on your television on the screen and you have that little wire in your ear, what you may be hearing is, let's ratchet it up. come on, get out there, attack her. And I think it has to do with the confusion of information with entertainment in our media today. So there's a lot of competition for audience, and I think producers often feel that if there isn't a lot of conflict, the audience will get bored and switch channels. So that, and that makes it so much harder for people to actually get nuanced views out there and see their own views represented.
Are there any other issues, do you think, that divide Americans as deeply as the abortion issue?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think the abortion issue divides individual Americans all that much, but in terms of the public policy debate, there are a few that are as rancorous because of the level of discourse that's been in the media. And I was very moved by the your guest today in their success to ratchet down that level of rancor and getting rid of those hot button terms. I was really interested. Your caller made a comment about she didn't get angry until the other person got angry. Often in arguments, each of us thinks the other one introduced the element of anger.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the other person might have looked at it a different way.
Yeah. And often it is those hot button terms. So one person might use a term that just sets the other one off, and each one thinks the other one is the one that introduced that hostility into the discourse.
Well,
so getting rid of those terms is such a good first step.
I'm sorry, did I hear somebody trying to get in from Boston?
Yes, Neil, I was. I think it's important to acknowledge that although we were able to converse about these things and these differences, it didn't change the fact that the differences are really of enormous importance when it comes to public policy. And it doesn't change the feelings, I think, that both Madeline and I have about the importance of being effective advocates on our side of the issue from a public policy point of view.
Well, Deborah Tannen, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, and again, thank you for having the show.
Well, thanks again. Deborah Tannen is the author of I Only Say This Because I Love You, Talking to Your Parents, Partners, Sibs, and Kids When You're All Adults, and she was speaking with us from her office here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's get back to the phones, and our next caller is Chris, who joins us from Minneapolis.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I consider myself to be both pro-choice and pro-life, and have long wondered whether opponents could have a civil dialogue on this topic. I tried to have a discussion with someone from the other side, the editor of one of the local Catholic newspapers, because of its rather subdued response to the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. He said that the overwhelming response of its readers felt that Senator Wellstone should not have been given any recognition at all because of his pro-choice position. And I was absolutely incredulous and asked him to print some of those letters to see just what he was talking about. And he did so in subsequent issues. We both agree that access to good education, universal health care, affordable housing, livable wages, clean environment, animal rights, and gun control, as well as opposition to war and the death penalty were both pro-life and pro-choice issues. And in a New Year's editorial, he endorsed most of these issues, not just taking a stand against abortion.
Mm-hmm. And so did you feel that eventually you got a respectful audience from the editor?
Yeah, I did. I was glad to get to be able to have this discussion. I think that when I read most of my read that paper, people are just they're just so focused on the their opposition to abortion that these other issues seem to get pushed by the wayside. So when I brought this up, he acknowledged that he could see my point.
He could see your point.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much. And do you think that in the end that the readers of this particular newspaper had the opportunity to see things differently?
Well, I noticed that some of those letters, they were not all the letters were critical of Senator Wellstone. Many, of course, praised him for his advocacy for a broad array of social and economic issues, and they were concerned that he should not be just looked at through this very narrow prism, on the issue of reproductive choice.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Madeline McComish, your meeting's obviously focused on that very narrow issue, but were there areas of agreement outside of that?
There were a few. There were a few. Certainly, in our concern for helping the poor, and I believe that all of us were opposed to the death penalty. Can you think of anything else, Nikki?
Well, I think that one of the wonderful things about the dialogue is we came to know one another in very nuanced and complex ways, so that we went beyond just abortion in terms of talking about worldview. In which, of course, we did talk a great deal about our commitment to a better world and to better conditions for people throughout the world. And I think, in fact, there were a lot of similarities among us in terms of the activism, the commitment to having women have an important role in the world in supporting women.
Certainly, yes.
It's just that there was this one very major difference in terms of how we thought women could be supported. I mean, the pro-choice side simply believes that women must be supported in terms of making their own reproductive health decisions, and Madeline, you say, you know.
Well, yes, that certainly a woman needs support, but the life of the child she is carrying also needs consideration.
We're talking with Madeline McComish and Nikki Nichols Gamble, members of the Public Conversations Project on Abortion. When we come back from the break, more of your calls, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, a look at Head Start and preschool and what they aim to provide for children and also possible changes in the future as the Bush administration considers reforms of Head Start. Today, we're talking about abortion and why it is so difficult for us to talk about abortion. Our guests are members of the Public Conversations Project on Abortion. They met secretly in Boston for 6 years. Three describe themselves as pro-choice, three as pro-life. Two of them are with us today from the studios of member station WGBH in Boston. Nikki Nichols Gamble, director of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, who served as president and CEO of Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts for 25 years, and Madeline McComish, who serves on the executive board of the Massachusetts Citizens for Life and is their past president. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And I wanted to begin with an email from Linda in St. Louis. What would your guests say to those in their camps who say that not being able to call things what they are, i.e. use those hot-button words, is capitulating to the other side? In other words, does talking to one another make them less for their side? Madeline, why don't you start?
Well, I can understand that viewpoint when it's like a first impression, actually, that they think, well, oh, you've given up or you've ceded something.
You've compromised the uncompromisable.
Exactly. But if they think about it, they would come to see that it's really impossible to talk about this in a reasoned manner if you use those hot buttons, because that's exactly what they are. They set off the other person who was on the other side. And so if you agree to set those aside, you can really discuss the issue. You can really discuss what is involved in abortion and what the consequences are.
Let me give you an example, Neil. We had a great deal of trouble finding a way to discuss the fetus or the child or the unborn child, and we finally agreed that we, for the purposes of our dialogue, we would call it a human fetus, which seemed to work for both sides as a compromise within our dialogue. Now, none of us agreed to do that externally all the time, so that some of the compromises or agreements we made within the dialogue were not ones that we held ourselves to necessarily in every other environment or venue in which we had to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of us felt that we ever compromised our commitment to a particular side of this issue. In fact, if anything, we probably all are more strongly ensconced in our advocacy position than we were before we started this. But nevertheless, I think, in fact, I guess I believe that the more sure you are of your own point of view, the better able you are with help and with assistance to really take a look at a different perspective.
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Kate, who's on the line with us from San Diego.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 22 years old, and I'm pro-life, and several of my just very closest friends are pro-choice and adamantly so. But we are able to talk about the issue, and even though we know that we aren't going to change each other's minds, I think that what I've found to be most productive is to be able to talk about the things that we do agree on, which I think has narrowed down to the fact that we both think that women's needs aren't being met fully, and I think that that's where the focus of the dialogue needs to go, that there are a lot of things that keep women from having an equitable stand in our society, and that we need to address those factors. And one group that I've volunteered with a lot, it's called Feminists for Life of America, and I've worked a lot with them to on my college campus to just make sure that resources are available for women. And I think that's something that people from both sides of the debate can agree that needs to happen and bring about productive changes, even while they disagree on that part of the discussion.
Are you in college?
I actually just graduated this month.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And was this an important issue for women when you were in school?
Yes, it is. It is. But I think that it's just important that women's voices be heard and their concerns be listened to. And I've actually had just a lot of really good experiences working in the pro-life movement, being able to feel like really productive changes were happening where those boundaries were being crossed and productive things were happening that were really helping women regardless of what position they take on the issue.
Well, thanks very much, Kate, and again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yes. I'd like to congratulate Kate, too. That shows tremendous maturity, I think, that at 22 she can really discuss this issue seriously with people on the opposite side. But that group, Feminists for Life, does reach out and cross a lot of boundaries because they really are deeply involved in helping women.
Let's see if we can get another call in. This is Kathy, who's with us from Bend, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, I just kind of wanted to share a little bit of a personal experience about really discussing this issue with people that don't agree with you in family. And it's been really, really important to me since I was about 15 years old to be able to to do that. I have a, my stepfather was a Catholic priest for many years, and he obviously came from a standpoint of being very, very pro-life, and he had taught philosophy and theology and ethics courses, and was, I'm really grateful that he was always very open to discussing this sort of issue with me without passing judgment or discouraging me from having the viewpoints that I actually had and still have today. And in fact, those discussions that I had with him really encouraged me to think very in very a detailed fashion about the abortion issue and how, why I am believing the things that I am.
So he didn't attack you for holding your views, but he made you defend them.
Absolutely not. He made me defend them very intensely, and this has been going on for about 15 years. and I think it's sort of invigorating for both of us, and we both agree that, like your guests have mentioned, that this discussing this with people that don't agree with you really enforces your own beliefs. It really makes you think them through and think, why do you believe what you do, and help you elaborate on it.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask Nikki Nichols Gamble and Madeline McComish if they all thought that we'd all be better off if we had either kitchen tables like yours, Kathy,
yeah,
or perhaps meetings like they've held. What lessons should we take away from your dialogue?
Well, I would like to say that one thing I really learned in the dialogue, and I think would be very helpful to everyone, is to really listen when you're talking to an opponent. To really listen, and if you don't understand, make sure you understand and are really hearing what they say. I think that would help you not only, it just would help you as a human being and in all your relationships.
And Nikki Nichols Gamble?
One of the things that I try to do in my life in general is to have conversations with people that are deep enough and thoughtful enough that they can encompass differences of opinion, and that one can be curious and explore different ways that people interact with ideas and with issues. So I think the kind of conversation we had is the kind of conversation I would like to have on every important topic with everyone who's important in my life. And I think what we've learned is that it takes some effort to do that. You know, it doesn't just come tripping off your tongue with great facileness all the time. You have to spend some energy in conversations at the level that we've talked for 6 years.
But it's worth it. It's really worth it.
Kathy, thanks very much. I gather you think it's been worth it, too.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call. And thanks to both of our guests. We really appreciate you coming in today and speaking with us. We know that isn't easy either.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Our guests have been Nikki Nichols Gamble, Director of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, and Madeline McComish, who serves on the Executive Board of the Massachusetts Citizens for Life. They are both members of the Public Conversations Project on Abortion. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.